Welcome, I'm Anna Jinja, your host of The Anna Jinja Show. I'm an international adoptee, an adoptee who has experienced the pain of rejection and the peace that comes with self-discovery and acceptance. Along the way, I've discovered that I am not alone. In some ways, we are all adopted into or out of homes, cultures, communities, and relationships as we grow and evolve. These experiences create who we are and who we are yet to be. So let's discover how we can be and become our best selves by connecting to the guest and creative content cradled in the belief that we belong, that we are worthy, and that we are loved in this world. So stay tuned and you may discover your own adoption story. Now today we get to have a conversation with an individual who is dedicated to changing the world. As a career coach, as a visiting professor in the Counseling and Higher Education Department at Ohio University, as an advocate for abused, neglected, and dependent children in our community, as a River Roasters coffee shop customer, in all ways, and whatever she does and wherever she does these things in her life, she is a super cool, awesome human being. And we're going to talk about the people and places that make who we are us. So welcome, Erin, or Dr. Erin Morgenstern.
Hi.
So welcome. What do you think our listeners should know about you before I dive in?
Big things. I'm an Appalachian, have been my whole life, born and raised, and I'm very, very proud of that. Took me a little while to get there, and I know we'll talk about that a little bit today. I love gardening, which Anna knows. We talk about it pretty regularly. So that's something that you won't necessarily see on a LinkedIn profile, but I'm also a master gardener. It's one of the things I really enjoy doing. And I'm a mom. I have a six-year-old at home, and he's amazing and keeps me on my toes.
Yeah, that's a lot. And you do, you may not be a gardener on LinkedIn, but what you do, and you can tell through your LinkedIn profile, is that you do things to nurture and to grow people and to grow community and to grow just friendships and relationships. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely one of your talents. So I'm going to ask you about your dissertation, but first I'm going to ask, so what led you to deciding that you wanted to pursue your PhD?
So it's a long roundabout story, but I'll give you the short version. I was working full-time in higher education for almost 15 years, the whole time knowing that living an entry-level and mid-level management position is pretty typical. A lot of people start with those jobs and end with them. But I have always been a lifelong learner. I really enjoy the idea of being a part of an academic community, whether it's a real academic community affiliated with an actual educational institution or just my community in general, having academic conversations. So when I was missing that in my full-time job, I learned that, you know, maybe it's not something I have to have, but it's something that I really truly desire to have and continue on with my education. And then the next level, oftentimes from a master's, is your PhD. And I had had my master's for a while. And I was also here on Ohio University's beautiful campus, connecting with a lot of educators that really spoke my language and enjoyed those philosophical conversations, and was encouraged to apply and start my PhD in higher education while I was working full time at the institution. So it wasn't necessarily what I knew from the very beginning of my academic life that that's what I would do. As a matter of fact, I kind of pushed it away for a really long time. And then I had so many people encouraging me to get back into the classroom and live my education dream, which inevitably, you know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be Indiana Jones, but I also wanted to be a college professor. And so if I could make that happen, I didn't think it could happen, but it did. And it really took a lot of mentorship and encouragement, but I finally did it. And it was the best decision I've ever made.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about people and places. And so connected to your pursuit of your PhD, we're going to talk about the people. So I'm going to ask you to read just a portion of the acknowledgement page of your dissertation. And I think that's probably the most neglected page when it comes to your defense. But I think for me and this purpose, the most important part. So just if you would read a couple of sections of your acknowledgement page.
Absolutely. First and foremost, I want to thank my committee members, Dr. Laura Harrison, Dr. Peter Mather, Dr. Laura Black, and Dr. Nancy Manring. You accepted my invitation to join my committee with excitement and offered steadfast support. You made me feel like my ideas mattered, and I could not have done this without your critical feedback, coffee chats, virtual meetings, and incredible expertise. I feel fortunate to know and have learned from each of you during my time in a doctoral program. The time and energy and support it took to complete this dissertation and my degree would not have happened without the people closest to me, my family. Justin and Rowan, I am forever blessed to have you in my life, to encourage me every day with a "you can do it, mommy," Olaf, my sweeter than sweet American breed pound puppy, you've kept me warm on the days when I didn't think I could go on. Thank you to my forever educators, mom and dad, for feeding my passions as a child and being truly honest when you told me I could do anything when I grew up. And to my brother, Bub, Sean Bond, your drive, determination, and fierce love for Lindsay, Dempsey, and Brighton is something that I will forever admire. As indicated by the title I gave her in my cell phone contacts, Jody, quote, my bestest friend, quote, unquote, Pavel, has been the cheerleader in my corner, shoulder to cry on, and forever sister from another mister. I can't imagine starting this whole process without her pushing me to do what I was meant to do and be my best self always. Love you, sis. For caring and supportive peers, colleagues, and students who made this this long process digestible. I wouldn't be here without them falling into my life at the right time in this academic journey. Though the people closest to me are the most important part of my completion of this journey, my Southeast Ohio community and places in it played a substantial role in keeping me motivated and encouraged to focus on my passions and enjoy the process. Thank you to the countless hours spent in the Riverview Room of the Meigs County Public Library, hundreds of cups of coffee from River Roasters Coffee Company, and endless smiles, waves, hugs, and fist pounds from the employees at these establishments. I love where I am from, where I live, and have great pride in the Appalachian roots that filled my soul every day.
I love that so much. And so the definition of adoption that as a transitive verb is to take by choice into a relationship. And usually that is an adopted relationship with a child. But if we just talk about to take by choice into a relationship, the people that helped you earn your degree were people that you, by choice, brought into your life. So you had to choose your committee, right?
Yes, I did.
They don't assign you a committee.
Nope.
You have to figure out who are the people that are going to be closest to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so these people that you recognize, which in full disclosure, one of them is my husband. So good shout out for him. Good committee member. And so when you're doing something as intense as the pursuit of your PhD, I imagine that these relationships become very, very important, central to what you're doing.
Oh, yeah, they're critical. Without them, I can 1,000% say that I would never have finished, because the doctoral program is one of the most isolating experiences that anyone will ever have. It is all about really what you want to do, your motivations, what drives you, and if you lose that drive in any way, shape, or form, a majority of people don't finish. The attrition rate of most doctoral students is about 50%. So they enter, but over half of them usually don't finish. And there's a lot of things that go into that, but having mentorship, having a solid foundation of support is incredibly important. So I'm really very, very grateful that I had that.
Yeah. So, and then you talk about the people that you selected, and then there's your family.
Mm-hmm.
So we had talked a little bit before about how your parents really gave you a love for the pursuit of education, just for the sake of education in itself.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember correctly.
Oh no, definitely. Yeah.
Yes. And so how do you feel like the people that you chose to be part of your committee, and then your immediate family, mm-hmm. how did that shape who you are? Who you are and who you're going to be through this process.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because when you're writing a dissertation, and anybody who's gone through that process, or even if you haven't, it's just good to know that there's this section of your dissertation called your reflexive statement. And so when you're writing that, it's really acknowledging who you are, the biases that you bring, but also your lived experiences that affect the way you look at the data that you're working within. And every single part of that statement for me really is enforced by the support systems that I had growing up, where I lived, my perspective on the world, the privilege that I had growing up, or the lack thereof, depending on, you know, the way that you look at things in the area and the region that I grew up in. And then also just recognizing how the interactions that I've had with just students and educational systems in general, how that affected the way that I looked at my data set. So definitely, you know, that's something that's really, really important in the journey for a dissertation, for a doctoral candidate. And so you can't do it without other people. Like I said, it can be really isolating. It can feel like you're 100% alone, but there's nothing about it that you can do without other people.
I love that too. Well, and we talked a lot a bit too about in your introduction about all the ways that you nurture and grow people. And one of the things that you do that I've heard over and over from your students and from other people that know you, Aaron, is how much that you care and love people and want them to be successful. So where do you think that comes from?
Oh, wow. That's such a good question, Anna. Because it's hard for me to pinpoint just one place where a lot of that comes from for me. I mean, I grew up in a family where there was never the good way to say this is you are not the only one in the world. Like, the world does not revolve around you. I think I heard my parents say that to me pretty regularly. Like, the world does not revolve around you. Actually, you're a part of the world, so you should be giving back to it instead of taking all of the energy from it. And so another thing that kind of always sticks with me about what they said is that, you know, it's a kind of an old adage that a lot of people hear in maybe if you're in natural resources or forestry or just generally interested in, environment, is that you leave things better than you found them. And that's absolutely the way that I was raised. And I think that a lot of that has to do with just the way that my parents think of the world and the way that they made me and my brother think about the world. I was also raised in a religious Catholic background. And so a lot of that is very service oriented. And that is a foundational part of who I am, even if it's not something that I currently practice. It's a big part of how I was raised and the way I had to think about that there are other people out there that need me and that I need to be of service to the people around me, because that's truly what my passion is. But it's also the only way that we can evolve is if we're of service to others. At least that's my belief. I think that has a lot to do with it.
Well, and I think that the way that you interact with your students or as a volunteer, I'm imagining when you're working with abused and neglected children, that they sort of adopt you as their coach and mentor, or maybe even a surrogate parent. And so when you're doing that, how do you manage that balance between getting so involved and then a balance of like protecting yourself too in your heart?
Oh, man, that's like one of the hardest balances to strike. I don't think I've ever been really amazing at it. I think you get better at it the more that you do it. Anybody who's in a service industry will tell you, or helping industry will tell you, social services specifically, when you're thinking about the way that you work with others, is obviously you recognize the social justice orientation that you have to come from, that these are circumstances that people have been in that is not their choice. That is a mindset that very few people have. But when you're a volunteer who already has that service-minded orientation, that you are trying to make things better, recognizing that the people that are dealing with these things didn't get to pick this. No one chooses to go into poverty. Nobody chooses to be born into a family that is dysfunctional or toxic or, you know, has abuse or any kind of neglect. They're not born into that with any choice. They just are given that. And so my role in that is to recognize that I can't always fix that. That's not what I'm supposed to do. But what I can do is be a resource for helping that person find resources for themselves and get to where they need to go. And when you're doing it with children specifically, at least in the court system, you are the voice of that child. Juvenile court does not bring children into the court system unless there's a criminal case and they happen to have them there. But very, very rarely are you ever even going to see them during your court days. They are typically not present. So you are that voice of that child. You're the voice of also kind of like in between systems that oftentimes are against one another. So you have to have a pretty strong moral compass. You also have to have a lot of understanding of what's going on in the system that is working against the child or against the family that's trying to figure out how to heal from, you know, generations of poverty. And again, I'm not meant to fix it, but I am meant to be an advocate for making it better. And so if I can do that, that's the role that I want to play. But it's not a role for everybody. It's not something that a lot of people can usually even stand. I learned a long time ago that I could be that person for other people. I really have always been a cheerleader in other people's corners. So the balance to strike is oftentimes something that I'm willing to take on a burden of caring. And I'm willing to oftentimes do things to help others, recognizing that sometimes that might put my needs second, but that it doesn't always have to feel bad to do that. I think some people really struggle with that. I'm okay with giving more of myself than maybe the, you know, the typical person, because I really do think that that makes things better. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're right. There's a balance to be struck there.
Yeah. Well, going back to that gardening thing,
yeah.
of being able to like nurture and know when to pull out the weeds,
yep.
right?
Yep.
And when it needs a little more water, a little more nutrients yeah. kind of thing. I think that's so important in how we include people in our life and the ways that we choose to be able to care and love for others when yeah. they're going through either pursuing their PhD or trying to figure out carrots or celery. What do I plant?
Yes.
So if you're just joining us, you're listening to The Anna Jinja Show. And our guest is Dr. Erin Morgenstern, and we are talking about people and places that shape who we are in this world. So I picked a song for you, Erin, by Ian Vidovic, a musician known as Road, who believes that everyone has their own path of life. And the song that I selected for you is this song titled I Could Change the World. Why did I pick that? Makes sense. So we're going to listen to this and talk a little bit about the song, and then we're going to move to a discussion about places that we pick and adopt in our life. So here is I Could Change the World by Ian Vidovic.
I could change the world with a flavored spark, and it's all I have imagined. 'Cause I know that we love sin. In this world, it's filled with madness.
There was that one particular phrase of I could change the world with a splintered heart. And the thing that I really connected with there is that even whenever you feel really broken, a lot of people lose a lot of hope. They don't think they can actually still do things. But I recognize that sometimes in that vulnerability, whenever your heart is broken, that you actually still have even more love to give. You have the ability to still give and be a part of the solution instead of the problem, because we do really live in a pretty sad place right now. And a lot of the people that we oftentimes serve in social services or when we're doing volunteer work are people who are at their lowest. And so even if you feel like you're at your lowest, you can still be there with them in community. And so I really connected with that.
I love that. Well, that song was for you, I Could Change the World, because you do change the world indeed, Erin. But let's talk a little bit about your world. In that last part of that acknowledgement page of your dissertation, you wrote, I love where I'm from, where I live, and have great pride in the Appalachian roots that fill my soul every day. And so we talked a little bit about before, but with our listeners, I'd like you to talk a little bit about how you, where you came from, and then a little bit of rejection from where you came from, and then coming back home. So would you mind sharing a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I did not, even though I grew up in Appalachian, in the Appalachian Mountains, I always really felt like I didn't want to be affiliated with it because of all of the negativity that was attached to it. The understanding that when you're from a certain place that never really gets a lot of positive stereotypes associated with it, you tend to either try to disassociate yourself with it completely, or you almost go in the other direction and you overemphasize it in yourself, which can also be a detriment. I definitely was someone who tried to escape it whenever I was much younger. I purposely, something that I know you and I have talked about, is that to this day, I do have the ability to jump back into an accent, but I lost it on purpose. I remember being made fun of that accent whenever I first came to college, even. Even before I went to college, when I was interacting with people outside of my community, that there was this sense that whenever I would say something and I had my accent, it would kind of turn people off, or the first thing they would say is like, where are you from? And that, even then, the tone that the people would say that question, it was like, oh, I've let something about me that is oftentimes negative now be seen. And so you start to get really nervous about that. You're like, ooh, I need to pull that back, or I need to fit in now. So if I want to do that, I'm going to have to start letting it go. And that really, it was very powerful when I recognized much later in life how much of myself you let go of when you lose your own accent for a place that you love. It's your home. So I went away from that for a long time. And then really it was through education that not just educating myself, but truly like the educational system, understanding diversity and inclusion, understanding what happens to you whenever you disassociate from your own culture, that's actually a really normal thing for a lot of marginalized populations to do. Being Appalachian, being from rural Southeast Ohio, West Virginia area, that is just something that we all deal with. I think that we're oftentimes forgotten. We're the forgotten culture, even though we're in the midst of an institution that's literally housed within it. The people who are actually from here are not always the ones that are on this campus. So when I started to recognize, like, wow, that was the thing. That's the thing that actually really says a lot about who I am. Otherwise, I just look like the average person. I look like a privileged white woman, you know, in Southeast Ohio. I don't actually look, quote unquote, what you would consider somebody being from Southeast Ohio, which isn't one particular person. Again, I had to learn that. But now that I recognize that in myself, I'm really paying attention to it, even in the way that I educate my son, the way that I engage with my own community, like throwing a lot of those doubts out and accepting them and actually really being proud of them and talking about them and wanting to spend more time talking to the people in my community instead of pushing them away like I did for so long.
Well, how did you get to that point, though?
Oh, I mean, years of of reflection, spending time in my community. Actually, honestly, whenever I started volunteering again, because I did some volunteer work whenever I was K-12 teaching, and I also taught GED. And in that sphere, I was not necessarily denying my cultural connection to my Appalachian roots, but I was kind of like trying to tell myself that I'm above it, which also indicates to me that, wow, I had a really negative a stereotype even of myself when I was in those places. And then whenever I started going back into that community after denying myself for so long and going back into CASA and volunteering and working with my local community, I started to realize that the resilience and the amazing people who were in my community that I was denying so long were what make my community so amazing. And so I think that volunteer experience brought it back. Living here and not only having friends at the university or in academia really played a big role in that, because I started to get back to the fact that I'm like, I can't be around the same people who are always like me all the time. And I'm like, wait a second, I'm not even like these people that I'm around all the time. Where are my people? Oh, they're right next door. So spending more time with my neighbors, spending more time in my community, just getting a chance to get out there, meeting the local business owners and actually spending time with them. I'm a member of our local Pomeroy Book Club, so I started to spend more time with those community members as well. But it was a long road, but I finally found my way back to my home.
Oh, that is good. And so I wanted to ask you in these last couple minutes that we have together, so what advice do you have for our listeners to do? What should they do you think, to create a world where everyone can feel that they belong, that they're connected, that they matter, and that they're loved?
I think starting with the people that are already around you and talking to them about what they also are seeing in the love of their community and the things that they do. What do they care about? Something that we talk a lot about, I know that you and my husband have the similar interest, is like looking at things from a strengths growth mindset. Is it not looking at what people don't have, but looking at what they do have, and recognizing that your community is full of assets that oftentimes, because of the stereotypes that may be affiliated with it from a systematic perspective, we tend to deny those assets and we tend to look at them as weaknesses, as things that we don't have. And so telling those people that if you don't feel like you are a part of it anymore, try to look at it from a different perspective. Question what you are seeing or what you know or what you think is maybe not something that you've had a lot of control over, and take some of that control back. And in terms of finding just belonging is, you know, it can be really scary to try to find that sense of belonging yourself, but recognizing that there are systems in place that are there to support you. So using things like your local library, using things like local resources, considering a volunteer experience that can be a little bit more of an uplifting experience versus just a one-hit wonder, like something that's maybe longer term that you can spend time with your community and feeling a part of it again.
Yeah, so Erin, what I love so much about your story, and thank you for sharing that with us too, is just all the ways that you bring connection and the ways that you serve as a teacher, educator, as a volunteer, as a mom, all the things that you do. And this quote came to me when I was thinking about you being a guest, is that some people come into our lives and quickly go. Some people stay for a while and move our souls to dance. They awaken us to a new understanding, leave footprints in our hearts, and we are never, ever the same. And that's by a woman named Flavia Weeden. And I think about you and all the relationships that you acknowledge in your dissertation and about the people that you've touched, that you definitely are never, ever the same with the way that you love and care for others. So again, thank you for joining us. A thank you to Adam Rich with WOUB for engineering and editing today's program. Our subject matter expert is Dr. Melissa Rizzo, and our storytelling producer and engineer is Zoe Lambert. Our creative and editing team includes Maddie, Maya, Alexa, Linnea, and Mark. And our music producer is Nick Kazernas, who has been writing genre-twisting songs for over 30 years, including this show's theme song, Way to Me. And a special thank you to Ian Bedovic as well for sharing his songs with us for free. And I am your host, Anna Jinja, signing off with a reminder that the key to unlocking all things good in this world is love. Here, you are loved and you are home. Always a friend and fan, this is Anna Jinja wishing you days filled with love, laughter, and peace.